Right, we have come to the final text for today, namely the paper by Altman and her colleagues on innovation without information constraints. As we look into this paper, let's start with a pretty basic proposition. Right, so innovation management and management generally takes the form that it does because of certain tasks and certain constraints. As technology changes, management practices change, because technological change introduces new things for management to do. Right? Building and operating a railroad, to take Alfred Chandler's classic example, introduces a challenge of coordinating the effort of many, many people and lots of artifacts across time and space. And that challenge just didn't exist in a small craft shop. Right? So these new tasks create the need for managers to come up with new solutions to deal with the problems of new tasks. Right? You need to invent new forms of accounting, new ways of supervising, new ways of planning, incentivizing, etc., as new tasks emerge. Schumpeter, you will recall, saw this. Right? Innovation in organizational forms spur the gale of creative destruction, just like product and process innovation. This organizational or managerial innovation is constrained by available technologies, right? So absent rapid communication infrastructure, right? Think of the world without the internet or without telephone or telegraphs. You have to deal with the constraint that communication just takes a long time. Without electrical motors, if you think back to David's paper on the dynamo and the computer, you're just forced to design your shop floor of your factory in a particular way because you have to connect all your machines to a central steam engine. And this is going to create very particular challenges of observing your workers' efforts. So you might be forced to rely on foremen who are close to the production line in order to monitor what workers do. Or you might try to adopt some kind of bureaucratic techniques that standardize things in order to make observation at a distance possible. Now, these solutions, crucially, are shaped by technological constraints. And lifting those constraints may allow you to do management in different ways, because management does not have to compensate for those constraints. When we're dealing with innovation, the combination of tasks and constraints is, at least from this perspective, what defines why innovation management takes the form it does. The model of innovation that we've been dealing with is the model of innovation as something that gets done inside the organization and typically following the logic of functional or structural ambidexterity, gets done by a dedicated R&D department or by business units that are focused on exploration. This, importantly, is because the task of developing new business opportunities for the organization has been constrained by information costs. The task of developing new opportunities has been limited by the cost of processing, storing, and transmitting information. When these costs are high, Altman and her colleagues suggest, the best way to organize innovation work is in R&D units. When the costs are lower, though, things are going to change in a pretty particular way. When they drop, I'm going to quote, it allows for reductions and blurring of firm boundaries and call into question what the firm does and what resources it owns. This tension between a Chandlerian logic and a more open and community-centered logic calls into question many of the assumptions underlying the strategic and organizational research that has been treated as foundational wisdom in management scholarship. End of quote. Let's try to unpack that a little bit. I won't go into the details of decreasing information costs, right? The chapter is pretty lucid on the numbers, and they are, as you kind of expect from sustained exponential developments, pretty dramatic, right? Suffice to say that it's uncontroversial that the cost of processing and storing and transmitting information is incredibly lower than ever before, right? But what does this mean? Well, imagine the classic view of R&D as a firm-centric and essentially closed activity. When information costs are insurmountably high, the R&D would happen in total isolation because any external search would just be really costly to justify relative to in-house development. But if costs fall, we can imagine organizations working with external partners to some extent. They might begin to operate on the markets for technology, might license out or license in technology, or they might engage in alliances based on what Altman et al. Called the custom negotiated relationship. But what if costs keep dropping? then it becomes possible to work much more across the boundary of the organization. The first thing that becomes viable is to allocate innovation-related tasks to innovation workers outside the organization. As an organization, you can hire people to engage in innovation work on a part-time and flexible basis. That sometimes gets called the human cloud because, like cloud storage, you can flexibly rely on an external resource when and to what extent you need, and it will be cheap to transfer tasks to it. I should say in passing that while this can be really great for companies, it does raise all kinds of issues for workers who lose the stability that has been a staple of employment relations, at least in the latter half of the 20th century, and instead they become contractors or independent consultants. But for firms, this is obviously beneficial because, you know, following Joy's Law, you can not only flexibly hire in a labor force when you need more effort exerted, you can also hire in specialized competences as befit certain tasks. They can be hard to find, as broadcast search showed us, but still, you could do that. And essentially, we can think of the process that you're describing here as a form of broadcast search. You hire in specific problem-solving capabilities, and done well, this lets solutions find problems through self-selection by developers, and it does away with costly search and development efforts by firms. Now, this is different from firms engaging in developer ecosystems, right? In working with developer ecosystems, organizations can create platforms for external parties to innovate independently, possibly to create offerings that are complementary to what the organization itself does. Apps are kind of a canonical example, and their implementation in Apple's App Store and Google Play are quite well known, in part because so many of us use them. Where in a labor marketplace, you would see all that effort bought into the organization's own innovative work, in the developer ecosystem, external innovators operate independently within the constraints offered by the organization's APIs and developer resources. But communication costs could fall further. Information costs could fall further. And then you might see organizations engaging with the kinds of communities and users that Von Hippel talks about. Individuals or groups using or modifying products or developing entirely new things. Organizations, as we mentioned, can find ways to complement users' innovative activities or support them in order to create communities around their products. Such communities, as Von Hippel mentions, don't operate on the same principles of market exchange, and they tend to follow different community norms that are idiosyncratic to the community. As I've kind of alluded to, these changes raise challenges for firms. We are, to riff a bit on Foster, dealing with organizational technologies that are very early in their life cycle, and there's a lot of learning required. And they compete with entrenched, closed, R&D-centric ways of working because organizations are typically Chandlerian, both for good reasons of efficiency and for more ideological and institutional ones. That this is what we've always done and this is what we imagine works. In Chandlerian organizations, R&D is going to change from being performed, and I'm quoting now, being performed almost entirely by professionals employed within the firm, end of quote, to being, start quote, a joint activity spanning internal experts and external contributors, end of quote. As that happens, the work processes and symbols and myths surrounding many organizational activities, including those of R&D work, change. So for one, the boundaries of the firm are called into question. Consider this for an incumbent, right? Suddenly, when a large part of your innovation work gets done by outside partners, whether they are sophisticated part-timers or contest participants or independent users, how does the organization manage this process and how do internal R&D workers contribute value? Hila Lifshitz-Asaf has an interesting paper on this, examining what happened in NASA when they began relying more on external innovators. And it's called Dismantling Knowledge Boundaries at NASA. Her overarching argument is that not only those R&D workers who let their professional identities change, essentially from being problem solvers, developing new solutions, to becoming solution seekers, uninterested in where the solution comes from, only those people are able to benefit from open forms of innovation. That's a pretty dramatic organizational change. For new entrants and entrepreneurs, we can imagine them committing early on to open strategies, and we can see them focusing on building the knowledge of how to manage external partners, whether those partners are individuals or communities, and having the knowledge or having that knowledge constitutes a firm key resource as opposed to in-house development capabilities. Right? Being able to compete on innovation without investing in in-house innovation capabilities might, as was the case for markets for technologies, lower the barriers to entry into an industry and increase the competitive pressure on incumbent firms. Doing so, however, requires that firms orient themselves towards understanding and working with interdependence and engagement with those communities, those external partners, and that carries implications for the kind of leadership and identities that firms can viably pursue. You still need to understand your technology, but now you also have to understand and manage those external partners that help you develop it. And you need to find ways to articulate what your organization does that is not about technology leadership and creativity, invention, and innovation in the classic sense. The chapter that you've read, I think, is interesting in its presentation of this, because by raising questions rather than giving what seems like answers, it captures well the sense that we are on the cusp of something new, a new and emergent approach. In much the same way that the corporation and the multi-divisional form and the corporate bureaucracy and the factory and the global supply chain all had to be invented at some point and perfected over time, the organization of innovation without information constraints is currently something that is being invented and perfected. The way that I encourage you to think about this is, perhaps unsurprisingly, to return to an understanding of information as widely distributed in society. Basically, an Austrian Hayekian point, as you saw presented by Shane. This, I would suggest, is the way that things have always been. At a certain point in time, however, the cost of gaining access to that widely distributed information simply became too great relative to other approaches for it to be worthwhile for organizations to seek it out. The benefits of in-house development, driven by a specialist in particular knowledge domains, basically beat it out. It became too costly, mostly because many of the problems that R&D dealt with required lots of effort to solve, and because organizations learned how to manage R&D well. That last part is about the organizational technology of R&D maturing, and first is about, and as we kind of put the third industrial revolution behind us, many R&D problems might have taken on a slightly different paradigmatic form. What we see now, though, is that reduced communication costs make it viable to embrace the distributed nature of knowledge once again, because it becomes less costly to seek out solutions. From this perspective, the polemical take is that really R&D as a corporate function, as something that firms do alone with their own experts and without outside collaborators, is really a brief historical exception that will in time be relegated to the ash heap of history. Innovation was never really meant to be something that large firms should do because, except in pretty particular circumstances, they don't do it particularly well, as many of the texts that you have read attest to, from Abernathy via March to Henderson and Clark and Christensen, and all the points of view on ambidexterity. They all kind of point to the inherent challenges that being large bring for innovation. That is, at least for the time being, is probably the case that some activities will remain confined to corporate R&D, but the question is how long that will last and the extent to which the ability to innovate in open ways will be the advantage that allows a new form of organizing to creatively emerge, possibly destroying incumbents, those relying on closed R&D forms in the process. As they say, we live in interesting times, and the object of innovation management study is something that is constantly evolving. And this paper does, I think, an excellent job of documenting that. That's all for today. I look forward to discussing these issues with you in class. Enjoy your further preparations and see you then.